Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're jumping right in today, kicking things off with a pretty bold claim from the legendary theater critic Frank Rich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he once described the subject of today's deep dive as Broadway's own brassy, unlikely answer to King Lear.
Which is just a massive statement.
Right.
Yeah.
Think about that for a second. King Lear on Broadway, but, you know, with tap shoes and show tunes.
It's a huge claim to make, but when you actually look at the sheer scale of the tragedy and the absolute force of nature at the center of the story, it is entirely justified.
It really is. And to get to the bottom of this, we are pulling from a massive stack of sources today for you. We've got historical theater reviews, cast memoirs, retrospective articles, encyclopedic deep dives, all to explore the legendary 1959 book musical Gypsy.
Such a classic.
It really is. And our mission today is to uncover the fascinating, often turbulent history of how it was made, dig deep into the psychology of the ultimate, terrifying stage mother, and reveal the behind-the-scenes drama of a show that is frequently called the greatest American musical of all time.
And to truly understand this, let's set the stage for you. Imagine the backdrop right now shifting to a glowing vintage theater marquee. The bulbs are buzzing and flashing against a dark brick wall.
I could see it.
Right. This is the gritty, relentless world of early 20th century show business. Now, the musical Gypsy is loosely based on the 1957 memoirs of the famous striptease artist Gypsy Rose Lee.
Loosely based.
Very loosely. But the real focal point of this story, the gravitational center that pulls absolutely everything into its orbit, isn't Gypsy at all. It is her mother, Rose.
Madame Rose.
Yes. A woman whose very name has basically become shorthand for the ultimate, relentless, and suffocating showbiz parent.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because looking through the notes here, the origin story of how this theatrical dream team came together
seems
almost as dramatic as the actual script.
Oh, it's a mess.
Yeah, it started with the notoriously tough Broadway producer David Merrick. He read a chapter of Gypsy Rose Lee's memoirs in Harper's Magazine. He pitches the powerhouse actress Ethel Merman, and they bring in Leland Hayward to co-produce.
A heavy hitter.
Exactly. You would think with that kind of industry muscle, putting the creative team together would be a breeze.
Yeah.
But didn't almost everyone say no at first?
They absolutely did. It was a string of polite and honestly some not so polite declines. First, they approached the musical titans of the era. Irving Berlin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he passed. Cole Porter. He also declined. Even Arthur Laurence, the man who would eventually write the book for the musical, initially walked away.
Wait, so what actually changed Laurence's mind? If he wasn't interested in a showbiz biography, what brought him back to the table?
He had a massive epiphany. He looked past the sequins, the cheap hotel rooms, and the vaudeville routines, and he realized what the true psychological core of the story actually was.
Which was what?
It wasn't about a stripper's rise to fame. It was a story about parents living their own unfulfilled lives through their children.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Once he saw that universal, deeply human tragedy at the center of it all, he was all in. That pivot is what elevated Gypsy from a standard biography into a masterpiece of a book musical.
Where the story and the psychology drive the show.
Exactly. Rather than just being a flimsy excuse to string some catchy songs together.
That makes total sense.
Oh.
So Laurence is on board for the story. But what about the music? Because there is a fantastic piece of trivia in the sources about Stephen Sondheim's involvement. And it sounds like there was some major friction.
There was a ton of friction. The director, Jerome Robbins, desperately wanted Stephen Sondheim to do the show. They had just collaborated on West Side Story with Laurence, so the creative chemistry was proven.
Right. They were a winning team.
But Ethel Merman put her foot down. She absolutely refused to have an unknown composer writing her music. She demanded an established hitmaker, specifically Jule Stein, to write the score.
Which means Sondheim was essentially being asked to step back and only write the lyrics, right? That had to sting.
Oh, it was a massive blow to his ego. He was so insulted by the demotion that he almost flat out refused the job.
I don't blame him.
It actually took his mentor, the legendary lyricist Oscar Hammerstein, to sit him down and convince him to swallow his pride and take the gig just for the sake of the experience.
Wow. Thank goodness he did.
What's fascinating here is how this forced slightly reluctant collaboration resulted in an absolute masterpiece that perfectly mirrors the themes of the show.
How so?
Well, you have Jule Stein's brassy, bouncy, traditional show tunes colliding head-on with Sondheim's incredibly sharp, character-driven, and often cynical lyrics.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, that tension, that shotgun marriage of musical styles, it creates this brilliant cognitive dissonance. It perfectly captures Rose's toxic optimism, mm-hmm. upbeat melodies masking a really dark, desperate reality.
It's the perfect storm of talent.
Yeah.
So knowing you're already familiar with the broad strokes of the plot, let's look at how that toxic optimism plays out. In Act One, we get the setup.
Right.
We meet Rose, this domineering force pushing her two daughters onto the vaudeville stage. You have the talented golden child, June, and the shy background sister, Louise.
The dynamic is so clear from the start.
Exactly. And we all know June eventually gets sick of the suffocating control, elopes with a dancer named Tulsa, and completely abandons the act.
Which is devastating for a normal parent.
Right. But the way Rose reacts to losing her star attraction is what really defines the show, isn't it?
Exactly. For a normal parent, losing your child because you push them too hard would be a wake-up call, a moment for deep reflection.
A time to step back.
But for Rose, it is merely a logistical roadblock. Undeterred, she instantly and terrifyingly pivots her manic focus onto the shy, untalented Louise.
Oh, that's silly.
She vows to make her a star, which brings us to the close of the first act with the legendary anthem, Everything's Coming Up Roses.
And if you just read that title on a piece of paper, Everything's Coming Up Roses, sounds like a happy, triumphant song.
It sounds lovely.
But in the context of the story, it is a threat. It is the sound of a woman completely losing her grip on reality and willingly shoving her remaining daughter into the meat grinder.
Precisely. Which brings us to the breaking point in Act Two. Vaudeville is completely dead. Rose, her loyal manager Herbie, and Louise have hit rock bottom.
The lowest of the low.
They are so desperate for cash that they accidentally book themselves into a burlesque house in Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Rose is horrified, but when the star stripper gets arrested right before the performance, Rose simply cannot resist the darkest urge imaginable. She volunteers her own daughter, Louise, to do the striptease.
Just to save the act.
Yes.
And that is the final straw for Herbie. He realizes she will never, ever change, and he walks out on her for good.
He does, and that leaves Louise completely alone on the stage, terrified. The other performers have told her that to survive in burlesque, she needs a gimmick.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the way Louise approaches this gimmick completely transforms her.
It changes everything.
She doesn't just go out and take her clothes off. She's shy, she's hesitant, so instead of a traditional routine, she drops a single shoulder strap.
Just one.
She slowly removes one glove. And most importantly, she speaks directly to the audience with a cool, refined elegance.
She treats them like gentlemen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She uses her intellect and her class as a weapon. That becomes her gimmick. It's not about sex. It's about power and withholding.
The tease.
Yes, that subtle tease is what turns the shy, awkward Louise into the sophisticated, major burlesque star known to the world as Gypsy Rose Lee.
And by achieving that stardom, she reclaims her autonomy. She takes control of her life, which inherently means leaving Rose behind.
Right.
This leads directly to the climax of the show, Rose's final devastating breakdown in an empty dressing room. She sings Rose's Turn, an explosive, almost schizophrenic musical sequence where she finally drops the facade.
The ultimate reveal.
She admits the horrific truth. She didn't push her daughters for their sake. She did it all for herself, to live vicariously through them because she felt she was denied her own chance at greatness.
The psychology of Madame Rose is endlessly debated in the reviews and articles we looked at. The critics of the time were not kind.
Not at all.
Clive Barnes called her bossy, demanding, horrific. Frank Rich simply called her a monster.
Harsh words.
But Stephen Sondheim actually defended her, calling Rose a very American character, a gallant figure, and a life force. I have to push back on that a bit, though.
Okay, why?
Forcing your kid into burlesque just to keep your own showbiz dream alive. It's really hard to see the gallant figure Sondheim is talking about.
It is a totally fair point to make, and it's why the character is so brilliant. She does monstrous things. But the people who have to actually inhabit the role see the nuances.
The actors themselves.
Right. Bernadette Peters, who played the role to massive acclaim, had a very empathetic view. She didn't see Rose as a cartoonish villain.
How did she see her?
She viewed her as a deeply vulnerable woman who was severely traumatized by her own mother abandoning her at an early age.
Oh, the generational trauma.
Exactly. That generational trauma, that desperate longing for validation and control, is what fueled her blind ambition. It's a masterclass in writing a complex anti-hero decades before Tony Soprano or Walter White hit our screens.
That is such a great comparison. And the music scoring this descent into madness is just legendary.
Mm.
Small world, together, let me entertain you, the hilarious, you gotta get a gimmick.
So many hits.
But looking at the production notes, the creative process seems incredibly chaotic. Were there some pretty significant songs left on the cutting room floor?
There were, and the reasons that they were cut really highlight the brutal, practical reality of putting on a Broadway show.
What's a good example?
Take the song Mama's Talkin' Soft. It was meant for the two little girls playing Baby June and Baby Louise. It was cut partly because the show was running too long, but the main reason was a staging disaster.
What happened?
The young actress playing Baby Louise had to stand on a platform elevated high above the stage, and the poor girl was absolutely terrified of heights.
Oh no.
They couldn't get her to do it, so they just scrapped the whole number.
That is wild. Just totally cut it. And there was one for Herbie that got cut too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of a memory issue?
Yes, a song called Nice She Ain't. It was intended for the actor playing Herbie, Jack Klugman. But it was handed to him during the pre-Broadway tryout tour, only a week before opening night.
A week.
Just a week. Klugman simply couldn't memorize the new musical keys and the complex staging in such a short amount of time. It was a physical impossibility, so they pulled it.
That sounds incredibly stressful.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the songs that did survive this grueling process are the ultimate example of what musical theater strives to be.
How so?
As the critic Ben Brantley noted, in Gypsy, there is no separation at all between song and character. The songs aren't just pretty breaks in the plot. They are the dialogue, the internal monologues, the weapons, and the armor of these characters.
It is the ideal reason for a musical to exist. And because the material is so incredibly rich, playing Rose has become this mythic, almost insurmountable peak for musical theater actresses.
Oh, absolutely. The Mount Everest of Broadway.
But when you look at the lineage of women who have played her, it's not just a straight line of identical performances.
Yeah.
Every generation completely reinvents her.
Exactly. You start with the brassy, booming tradition of the original in 1959. Ethel Merman.
The icon.
Her cast album won a Grammy and was actually her first recording in stereophonic sound.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For listeners at the time, that was revolutionary. It captured the wide spatial energy of a live Broadway orchestra right in their living rooms.
That must have been incredible to hear back then.
Yet, incredibly, the original production famously lost all 8 of its Tony nominations.
Which is still mind-blowing to me. All 8.
Crazy.
Then you look at the 1970s. Angela Lansbury opened the show in London and brought it to Broadway in 1974. But she wasn't even the first choice.
No, she wasn't.
She was only hired after Elaine Stritch couldn't secure the necessary funding from producers.
Yeah.
Lansbury steps in, completely makes it her own, and wins the Tony.
A legendary pivot.
Then you have Tyne Daly in 1989, bringing this fierce, gritty, dramatic acting background to the role. And she also wins the Tony.
And then you get these fascinating tonal shifts. In 2003, director Sam Mendes cast Bernadette Peters entirely against type.
Right, because she wasn't that big, booming presence.
She was tiny, ladylike, and vulnerable. A stark contrast to the merman mold. Mendes wanted someone closer to the physical reality of the real Rose Hovick.
Did it work?
It was polarizing, but it broke Schubert Theater box office records, taking in over $870,000 in a single week. Though sadly, it still closed at a financial loss.
Wow, even with those numbers. Contrast that vulnerability with 2008 when the absolute force of nature that is Patti LuPone took over.
Oh, fine.
She developed her performance with a literal live lamb on stage.
Yep.
And she demanded respect for the theater, much like Rose demanded attention. LuPone famously stopped the performance right in the middle of Rose's turn on the eve of closing night to absolutely scold a patron who was taking illegal photos.
It was a legendary moment of life imitating art. She was not having it.
Not at all.
Following LuPone, you have the 2015 West End revival where Imelda Staunton delivered a powerhouse performance that swept the Olivier Awards, winning 4.
Incredible.
And that brings us right to the present day with the 2024 Broadway revival starring the incredible Audra McDonald running until August 2025.
Directed by George C. Wolfe, right?
Yes. But there is a theatrical detail about all these different revivals that is truly brilliant. The ending of the show, the literal final moments on stage, changes depending entirely on the production and the director.
I love this part. Tell us how drastically it shifts.
Okay, so in the 1974 Lansbury production and the 2008 Lupone production, the show ends on a very bleak, dark note. After Rose's turn, Louise walks away, laughing sarcastically at Rose's endless delusions of stardom, leaving Rose completely alone on stage, staring at a fading, unrealistic marquee.
Ouch, that is cold.
Very cold.
But then, the 2003 Bernadette Peters version leaves it completely ambiguous. Louise walks through the stage door, and Rose turns to the audience with a look of profound sadness, takes one last look at the empty stage, and slowly closes the door. You have no idea if they reconcile or not.
It leaves you hanging. And finally, in the 2015 Staunton and 2024 McDonald productions, the ending is much warmer.
A total flip.
Yeah. After Rose wakes up to reality, mother and daughter tentatively move toward reconciliation, embracing and walking off the stage arm in arm. It is the exact same script, but with a completely different emotional impact.
So what does this all mean? How does a show from 1959 maintain such a grip on our culture that we're still endlessly restaging it, arguing about its ending, and trying to adapt it for the screen?
Well, the screen adaptation certainly helped cement its legacy outside of New York. You had the 1962 film starring Rosalind Russell, who won a Golden Globe.
A classic.
And the 1993 TV movie starring Bette Midler is a fascinating artifact because it's a rare example of a television musical where the actors actually sang completely live on the set rather than lip-syncing to a pre-recorded track.
Which is so hard to.
It gave it an incredibly raw theatrical energy.
But looking at our sources, perhaps the most interesting screen adaptation is the one that got away. The Barbra Streisand saga.
Oh, man. It really is the ultimate phantom movie.
Truly.
For nearly a decade, between 2011 and 2019, Barbra Streisand relentlessly pursued starring in and producing a feature film remake of Gypsy. It just kept bouncing around Hollywood.
From studio to studio.
It went from Universal Pictures to STX Entertainment. They had heavy-hitting writers attached at various points. Julian Fellows of Downton Abbey, Richard Loggemeins.
Huge names.
And later, they were even linked to Amy Sherman-Palladino to write and direct. But despite all that firepower and Streisand's unwavering determination, the film never materialized.
It's almost incredibly fitting. A story about the agonizing pursuit of showbiz dreams having its own unfulfilled Hollywood dream.
The irony is rich.
Which brings us to the end of our deep dive. Why should you, listening right now, care about a stage musical written in 1959? Because, as we've seen from the reviews and the psychological breakdowns, Gypsy isn't just a history lesson about the death of vaudeville.
No, not at all.
It is a terrifying, beautiful masterclass in understanding human ambition. Everyone in this story is starved for attention. That deep, gnawing craving for the spotlight, for validation, is the very motor that keeps show business running. And honestly, it is often the motor that keeps our own lives running, too.
This raises an important question. We just talked about how different directors can completely change the ending of this show.
Right.
Without altering a single word of Arthur Laurent's script, one director can leave you with a warm, loving embrace between a mother and daughter, while another leaves you with cold, sarcastic abandonment.
It's wild to think about.
It really makes you wonder about the monsters in your own life. If the exact same shared history can be viewed as either a tragic, inescapable cycle of abuse, or a triumphant story of eventual reconciliation, depending entirely on where you decide the curtain falls. Who is holding the pen to the ending of your own story?
Wow, that is definitely something to chew on. We want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material today. Keep asking those big questions, keep exploring the fascinating world around you, and we will catch you next time.